Our next speaker is Mr. Mick Wallace.
Madness.
Madness.
This is madness.
We cannot fix a problem caused by capitalism with more capitalism.
They hurt the people.
I ended up at the end of a gun
on three occasions.
I done well to survive anyway.
Madame Deli will speak.
A union which allows fiscal rules to be broken for arms expenditure,
but not for housing or to put roofs over the heads of people.
This is evidence of police violence. Whether you're an economic migrant or you're an asylum seeker, nobody deserves to be treated like this.
And even having the neck to suggest separating people from their mothers. How dare you?
They don't need us to kick them around the place.
You could say it, so what?
This is a
police
joke.
In riot gear with truncheons. I am ashamed to call myself a
the
European.
Recognition of Guaido,
elected gobshite, is an absolute embarrassment.
Now, you did use the word gobshite, and I would reprimand you over that.
Hey, bonjour, everybody here in Strasbourg yet again. 6 weeks into the war in Ukraine. Obviously, that's the main show in town here in the European Parliament. We've also had discussions on Afghanistan and on other items, but I've been on my travels, so Mick's been holding fort here. I've been in Guatemala, which I'll talk about in a minute. I have to go to Greece for the trial of the two Afghan refugees who are currently serving 50 years in a Greek jail, allegedly for people smuggling, even though they are the victims of smugglers. So that trial, which we reported on a couple of episodes back, is due to be heard, fingers crossed, tomorrow in Lesbos. So I'm heading out there for that. So I haven't really been holding forth here, Mick. You've had to shoulder everything here. So tell us what you've been up
to.
I know you've been speaking a lot.
It's lunchtime on Wednesday. Now, it's been a pretty crazy week in terms of the Parliament stuff. I have spoken a lot on different... I've spoken 9 times so far this week, and it's kind of only a little over halfway through. A bit mad, but... we had two resolutions that kind of dominated the week and took up a lot of time. We had one on Ukraine and we had one on Afghanistan. And finding consensus within the GUE group, it's called the Left in Europe now, is pretty difficult. And then when you eventually come up with a resolution that is acceptable, kind of acceptable to everybody, where everyone is compromising a bit, you then go into dialogue and negotiation with the other groups, and it's hard to know which is the more difficult.
Yeah.
There's a pair of them in it, in the sense that, listen, it's difficult anyway. People don't... I would say that... I mean, there's 7 groups in the Parliament, and I would say that... the more right-wing groups probably find it easier to find consensus. They kind of tend to be on the one page anyway. And like, for example, when it comes to Ukraine, they're generally pro-NATO, pro-US imperialism. When it comes to Afghanistan, they don't seem to have a problem with the sanctions and just give up with the Taliban. Whereas, obviously, the stories are a lot more complex. When it comes to our own group, there'll be divisions as well. The group is called the Left, but it doesn't mean that everyone in it is left. But, you know, we try and work together and come up with a consensus of sorts, and but it's very difficult. And to be honest now, I'm pretty soul-destroying as well, and not one of the things I enjoy the most.
No. I mean, look, I suppose from our point of view, the Afghanistan resolution was easier, with a small e. But the Ukraine one is maybe a little bit more complex. I mean, I think we signed the one on Afghanistan, so we did sign off on the general one, which, you know, there are huge problems now in Afghanistan. Of course, we condemn the Taliban's exclusion of women and from the workforce and girls from education. But the truth is that the Taliban are going to have to revisit that situation anyway. They're dealing with an organisation that has, I suppose, hardcore dyed-in-the-wool Taliban anti-women people to broader, more, you know, normal Muslim types in their ranks. And there's probably a you know, a conservative wing and a more liberal wing there as well. And they're probably trying to keep them on board against the backdrop of where under the pain of the sanctions that's been imposed on Afghanistan, the country is absolutely stagnating, 97% of the population in danger of poverty and so on. So they have a difficult role, and the position we've taken has been very much to highlight the need to release the cash to allow the economy to function so that people can live and survive, because otherwise they're dying of hunger and starvation. And one of the saddest things over the past period has been completely under the radar. There's been two international donor conferences, which is what they call it. So countries that have been basically pauperized from interference from other areas, and in this instance, Yemen and Afghanistan, went to the international community to ask for donations to help them get money which would be the difference between millions of their people potentially starving to death or not. And on both of those donor conferences in the last month, they'd be left billions short of the money that they needed just to survive. And yet, at the same time, the European Union has no problem finding billions to keep in the war going in Ukraine. I mean, it's just disgusting, the double standards that are there.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. I mean, in part of the negotiations on Afghanistan, it was almost as if I was being accused of being supporting the Taliban. Right? I mean, the Taliban were actually almost invented by the Americans and the Saudis to undermine a socialist government in Afghanistan at the beginning of the 80s. Mm. What the Americans and the Saudis did at the time was they armed the Mujahideen, and Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, grew out of the Mujahideen. And this is where the problems originated from. Afghanistan, the role of women in society in Afghanistan in 1980 was a lot better than it ever was since the Taliban. Even when the Taliban originally took over in the late 90s, American invasion, they went back into the hills, but eventually came out of it 20 years later over $2 trillion later, the Taliban came out stronger and availed of all the billions worth of military equipment that the Americans and the EU gave to the propped up Afghan regime that were bugger all better than the Taliban in sense and how they were doing things, because it was a disaster anyway.
Well, it's an interesting point that you make. And I suppose, you know, ignorance of foreign policy is no defence in terms of the role of our media. But I find it ironic, like anybody who'd even scratch the surface would know that no left winger is going to support the Taliban. They're the anathema of anything that we stand for and our beliefs. But similarly, the way people think, oh, you're a Putin puppet, just because we don't go along with the warmongering in relation to Ukraine, like, you know. But I think that's highly ironic as well, because the idea like that, like Putin is supported by oligarchs, by very rich people. He's a right-wing neoliberal Russian nationalist. The idea that that would have anything in common with people who are left-wing or socialist, you know, the opposition to him is the Russian Communist Party. There are left-wingers in opposition to him. Like, so the idea that we would support Putin is just ludicrous. But it's how these generalities are bandied around in order to blur the discussion and the real need to analyse what's actually going on the ground is a bit sickening.
Yeah, and I mean, it was reported by some independent sources last year during the Russian elections that Putin stole the election from the communists. Mm. And you know what? If the communists had won at the time, the Europeans had been going epileptic. They would have said, what the hell are we going to do now?
Yeah.
Communists are back in Russia. In actual fact, they haven't really had a problem with a right-wing neoliberal nationalist in control for the last 20 years, 22 years now. It hasn't really bothered them a whole lot.
Absolutely.
But all of a sudden, it does. But, you know, look at, I mean, it's terrible on Ukraine. There's innocent people dying, but I find it shocking. I've rarely seen, especially in the early stages of a war, I've rarely seen so little effort at peace negotiations.
It's incredible.
And I know we give credit to France and Germany before the war started for trying to de-escalate, and they deserve that credit, but they haven't done a lot since. It's like as if they've all been reined in. And there's little doubt, but US and NATO are pretty content that the war is happening. It's undermining Russia. They're not too worried, really, about the people of Ukraine. And when you see the Europeans and the clamouring for putting more arms, more guns in there, I mean, it's only the Ukrainian people are going to suffer. But there's no, I mean, where's all this going? Like, where's the long-term thinking? I mean, you hear politicians calling for even more sanctions on Russia. I mean, they already admit that the sanctions won't stop the war. The sanctions will not stop the war. So what are the sanctions doing? Well, I mean, the sanctions are actually illegal because they're designed to totally undermine the Russian economy. And the people that will suffer most from that are the ordinary Russian people. The oligarchs and the decision makers in the Kremlin are not going to suffer from sanctions. In the real life, right? I mean, that's just the way it works. But the ordinary Russians will. And sadly, as we've been highlighting, is the ordinary Europeans. Bar there's going to be massive state aid brought in. The average European is going to face a serious cut in living standards. I mean, it's really scary, like.
I suppose, you know, and we just had a really heated discussion there this morning in the plenary, where I was getting heckled for simply arguing for peace and for a stopping of the war and for pointing out that actually the response being implemented by the European Union is a continuation of the response that they've had already, which is pump more weapons into Ukraine, which has been a process that's been ongoing for the past number of years and has been absolutely escalated now in the context of the war. Ratchet up the sanctions in Russia, which have been in place since 2014. Yet all of these policies which you've been implementing have got us to the stage where we are now, or they haven't stopped us getting to the stage where we are now. And yet you're arguing for more of the same, which is, as I said, the definition of insanity, repeating the same thing and expecting that you're going to get a different result, because it's not working. The sanctions, while they are certainly impacting on ordinary people and increasingly will in Europe, they're not actually having the devastating impact on the Russian economy that we're led to believe that it will have. The situation with gas and the position of the ruble now, they're doing quite well in terms of the amount of gas that they have access to. So this idea of depriving European economies from access to the gas is just absolute lunacy. It's just madness. And what I thought was annoying, but I suppose typical of what we've seen, like, I was interrupted in my speech or blue carded, which is when another MEP can ask you a question. And I was asked a question by this guy. Now, he's a kind of a nemesis of mine because he's an ultra right wing Bulgarian who yesterday was disciplined for doing a neo-Nazi salute in the parliament at the last plenary. So an ultra right wing, pretty vile nationalist whose party in Bulgaria would be rabidly corrupt and so on. And I've challenged him a lot, so he wouldn't be a fan of mine. So he interrupted me on the war and kind of abused me. And the Irish media's take on that was angry MEPs sort of object to what Daly says, when actually what we have is a rabid little neo-Nazi has a go at me because he's against me for loads of reasons. And somehow I'm the one who's to blame. I mean, it's just absolutely mental. And no, and our message, which is saying stop the war, how could that not be in the best interests of Ukrainian people? Clearly it is. Pumping more arms in means more dead Ukrainians. And I mean, obviously there have been in the media over the last period accounts of atrocities in Bucha and other areas. There was this revelation of a, you know, a grave with, you know, hundreds of people in it, allegedly, and, you know, violent atrocities carried out against Ukrainians. We don't know what the full story is and what happened there, although obviously the half of the European Parliament seems to think that they know absolutely, even though the circumstances haven't been independently verified or, you know, blame apportioned. There absolutely needs to be an investigation into that, and we would support that and support the holding to account those responsible, whoever they are. But at least we're saying whoever they are, because the truth is nobody knows who they are yet. People are blaming the Russians. They're blaming whatever. They absolutely could be the Russians. I'm quite sure there have been a lot of atrocities carried out, but that all needs to be independently verified and held to account.
Yeah, without a doubt, the level of disinformation coming about the war is probably at a new level.
Mm.
People would argue that the West is probably better at managing the information flow. I don't think the Russians are actually pretty good at it.
No.
I don't think the Chinese are good at it.
Mm.
I think they don't. I don't think they've got their heads around it. I think the West is very good at controlling and manipulating information, and they accuse the others of disinformation, and they're right. I think the Russians are guilty of disinformation. I think the Chinese are guilty of disinformation, but I think so are the Europeans and the Americans.
Mm.
And people should take on board all the time when they're being told something. Even if you're looking at images on television,
mm.
you don't actually necessarily know what really happened.
Mm.
And in relation to the alleged atrocities that are coming out of Ukraine of late this week, it's really important that the UN gets in there
mm.
and investigates it properly. And it's so important that everybody is held to account.
Yeah.
And everyone should be held to account for all war crimes, whether it's the Russians or whether it's NATO or Americans or whoever the hell they are.
We've been very disappointed with the UN before, but they have been incredibly disappointing in relation to their basic silence on this matter and their failure to take a lead. I mean, we've said we're disappointed with the European Union in going along with the NATO line and just promoting the continuation of the war, throwing in weaponry, ratcheting up the sanctions while, you know, not really delivering peace. Like, if you want peace, you've got to stop arming, you know, you've got to call for a cessation of hostilities. You don't keep encouraging hostilities. So that's what they're at. But the UN should have been doing that. And I actually, you know, we look at things from a very Western point of view, but a majority of the world's population has been a little bit standing back on this. I mean, it's interesting, I'll talk about it in a minute, about my short visit to Latin America, but obviously the war doesn't exist in Latin America for the people there. Life is going on with all of the problems that they experience. And one of the scary things out of this war is the ditching, and we heard it this morning in the debate, of hard-won environmental measures which have been put in place and are desperately needed to stop the catastrophic destruction of our planet being thrown out the window because of this war. I mean, there were people getting up this morning giving out about Germany closing down nuclear plants, saying there is another way, reopen the plants, get more LNG in, things that will actually just destroy the planet. Scary stuff.
But speaking of the UN, I'm one that's I really feel that a strong UN is so essential to international law, and it has been watered down. It has come to be a bit of a servant of US empire, and for me, the best example of all of that, unfortunately, was in Yemen, where the UN gave a resolution to allow the Saudi and UAE, with the support of the Americans and the French and the Brits, to bomb Yemen back into the Stone Age in order to bring about regime change. 400,000 are dead, according to the UN. 16 million have been driven into extreme poverty, and the EU has been silent on it. And the do-gooder politicians mm. in Ireland, I haven't heard them say a goddamn word about the terrible genocide taking place in Yemen. And it just puts things in perspective. And just to go back to sanctions for a minute, right? I mean, I did two speeches on sanctions this week, right? And I mean, I was pointing out that economic sanctions have become a weapon of war, right? And they're not as visible as aerial bombardment or tanks rolling across your land, right? But the murderous consequences are similar or sometimes even worse. In relation to Afghanistan, there's independent people saying that if Afghanistan doesn't get help, if their money, The Americans have frozen $7 billion belong to the Afghan state and won't give it to them to feed their own people because it's the Taliban running the place. They're robbing their money. They are condemning women and children to die because of freezing the money. And no one gives a damn. And there's nobody in Europe. There's so little support for lifting that and so little condemnation of the Americans stealing Afghan money that's needed to feed their people. Now, likewise, right, the thing about sanctions, right, even more so than bombing, right, sanctions will kill women and children and the sick and the elderly first and foremost, right? And the people that are voting for economic sanctions, right? And I'm sorry, but I just find it shocking that so many politicians can vote for economic sanctions that have a blanket effect on populations. I mean, do they not think that they have the blood of innocent people on their hands when they do that? Are they thinking it down? Are they thinking it through? Do they actually care about the people when they're doing that? And listen, this is not something we're making up, right? UN agencies, right? And multiple UN special rapporteurs on human rights have been shouting from the hilltops for years now about the hundreds of thousands of avoidable deaths that are the direct result of Western unilateral sanctions, be it Venezuela, Iran, Syria, Cuba, Zimbabwe, Yemen, Afghanistan. The list is endless. And I mean, we do it as if, this is the way to do things, right? I mean, have we any idea of what... I mean, we're looking at the Ukraine war on television and it's terrible. War is so ugly. I mean, hopefully it'll bring back to people the idea that war is ugly and terrible always. And what Putin has done invading Ukraine is absolutely shocking. And but so were all the other wars too. And there's terrible things happening every day and there's a blind eye being turned to them. And just to finish on the UN thing, right? I wish to God the UN were stronger. I wish to God they were totally independent. And unfortunately now, they sound like an NGO. They say the right things a lot of the time, but they ain't doing much. And I call for this week in the Parliament, I call for the General Secretary of the UN to start negotiating between Kiev and Moscow. He should be moving from city to city, right? He should be shuttling from one city to the other to bring about an end to the war. Where in God's name is he? He shouldn't be in New York. He should be going between Kiev and Moscow and putting an end to this war, because this war will not end with more guns and bombs. This war will end with negotiation and mediation. People compromising and ending the bloodshed. And that is not making any excuse whatever for the fact that Russia invaded Ukraine totally against the rule of law, an absolute disaster, and it's criminal what they did. To do that is terrible. To start any war war is always wrong, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, there's just, you know, so much stuff there. Like you were saying, the politicians sort of just in a cavalier way banging the drum and demanding all these sanctions and not thinking it through, and they are responsible for the deaths of innocents from their action. But the reason why they do it is that we don't have a media that's holding them to account for their actions, and that they're allowed bandy around these things and portray themselves in doing that as defenders of the people of Ukraine, even though it is the people of Ukraine who are actually suffering as a result of their actions. And as you say, yes, the primary responsibility for that rests with Russia. But we can't ignore the role of NATO behind the scenes, and we cannot apologise or excuse, rather, the role of the European Union, which is prolonging this war because of the attitude that it's implemented in this regard. It's absolutely ridiculous, you know, it's appalling.
What I find totally sickening, and I see some of the Irish politicians doing it as well, I see them actually jumping on the bandwagon, shouting and roaring. You know what? It's like as if the war was the best thing that ever happened to them, because it's an opportunity for them to promote themselves.
Oh, I mean, some of them, it totally is.
It is absolutely totally shocking. Is. Yeah, yeah. And I have to say, at home in Ireland, I've been really concerned about the role in particular that Fianna Fáil have played. And I have, and I don't think that Fine Gael have been as rabid about it. I think they've been a bit more measured. I'm not saying that I agree with what they're saying, but my God, Fianna Fáil seem to see this as an opportunity for themselves to win the next election.
Oh, well, totally. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the gas thing is that these are the people who talk about that word populism, you know, but this, if ever you heard of it, was this, where they're coming out with slogans and gestures which they think will get them social media likes or will get them a nice cushy headline in the media. They're the good guys. They're pushing an open door. It's absolutely pathetic. Like, and as you say, like, actually Fine Gael haven't done it in the main. Most Fine Gael people haven't. The odd Europhile can't resist, but generally they haven't. But Fianna Fáil have been totally pathetic. And it's really sad because the victims at the heart of this are the people who they claim to be representing, but they couldn't care less clearly about the people of Ukraine, because if you did, you'd be articulating and arguing for an end to the war. So, Camir, what else had you got to...
Well, just to finish on that, I mean, we probably should have known over the last, especially since 2001, the fact that these people have been so comfortable with allowing the US imperialism use Shannon as an airport, as a military base, to actually cause untold destruction in other parts
of
the world.
Good point, like, yeah.
Is not disconnected from their behaviour now. The jingoism that we're coming out of now, the level of absolute nonsense populism that they're engaging in is shocking, but it's actually, they have history.
Well, that's true. And I mean, the MEP, the Fianna Fáil MEPs here actually were junior ministers in government facilitating the illegal war and slaughter in Afghanistan and Iraq. And all during that time, they were doing business with America, foreign direct investment, come into Ireland, organise your taxes, lads. We'll make sure you don't have to pay tax anyway and rob the American people in that. They'd no problem with any economic dealings. And these are the very same people who facilitated that are the ones now who are saying you can't sell butter in Russia because somehow if you do, that's going to, you know, help the war effort. Like, seriously, did you ever, like, selling Kerrygold butter to the Russians is going to help save lives in Ukraine? I don't think so.
No, but as you said, it's an awful pity that we don't have an independent media to actually call it out. And when I was interviewed on the TV3, and in fairness to him, I found that TV3 covered our interviews in a fair manner, which was commendable. But when I was asked why did I vote against sanctioning Russia Today, well, I said, I don't believe in censorship. Let every side have its say. I mean, I said, well, he says, but they say stuff that promotes Russia. I said, yeah, so? I said, RTE wheel Fianna Fáil in morning, noon and night to promote US imperialism. I said, what's the difference? So let's listen to both sides. I don't think that we should close down RTE or the Irish Times or the Irish Independent or the Mail or the Irish Examiner, even, as bad as they are. But I mean, I don't believe in censorship.
But they should be subject to broadcasting regulations, which actually Russia Today is subject to, as well as the rest of them. Like, you know, we can argue about those standards, but they're all accountable. So what else do you speak on? And I'll talk about my travels.
Oh, Jesus Christ. I'm not sure where to start. No, you go ahead and talk about your travels.
Well, no, it was just interesting.
We had to vote soon.
We had the opportunity of making a short visit to Guatemala, and it's something that we'll return to because Guatemala is being featured on the plenary this week, which I'm really happy about. It means the majority of the political group saw the urgency of discussing the dire rule of law inadequacies that exist in Guatemala, and it's a subject that we'll definitely return to. Trocra in Ireland actually do really good work in Guatemala, and there have been appalling violations of human rights against the indigenous community, against legal representatives and so on. Recently, we've had a number of judges who were involved in anti-corruption cases who have been prosecuted. What sparked the debate in the plenary this week is the fact that four more anti-corruption prosecutors have been forced to flee the country. There are six in prison on very spurious charges with a politically appointed attorney general who turns a blind eye to corruption. There's been appalling scandals such as the expose of nickel mining. where against the interests of the ruling of the Constitutional Court in Guatemala, which ordered the closure of these mines, that companies there have been engaging in that environmentally hazardous practice, driving indigenous people off the lands, killing them. And I was privileged to meet the Codeca group, which is a group of a lot of indigenous population, the Mayan population, who are a majority in Guatemala, people fighting the neoliberal agenda and the multinational corporations which exist in Guatemala. And they have in a group, the MPL, which is a political group which fought the elections last time around and ended up in fourth position. And they're a group we're going to deal with more. It was really interesting. They've had a right to water campaign. They've had people without access to proper water, to electricity. And yet this is a very wealthy country in terms of resources. It was the country where the United Fruit Company overthrew governments before, and there's still the legacy of the disappeared. And on the wall you'll see young women and men and activists who were disappeared for standing up to US multinationals there in that society. So it was a privilege for me to meet the activists. They're looking for help from the European Union to oversee their elections next year. No doubt we'll get into trouble if we go there, but it's a plea from the people to come over and observe their elections next year, and I think it should be the start of cooperation with them. An incredibly interesting country, very humble and decent people.
Yeah, we'll probably hear more about it in the years ahead. It'd be great if there's a bit more of a spotlight put on it. Mm-hmm. I'll just touch on a couple of, just real briefly, a couple of things that I spoke on. I'll start with fish, right? And I got speaking time with the commissioner, Sinkevicius, and there's a report being done on the future of fisheries in the Channel, North Sea, Irish Sea and Atlantic Ocean, right? And I pointed out that the report completely ignores the fact that Ireland lost 15% of its quota under the agreement and was proportionally substantially more impacted by the trade and cooperation agreement than any other member state. And the report didn't really take that into consideration, right? And I was just making the point that, you know, there's a common fisheries review this mm-hmm. year, right? And it's so important that it addresses the completely disproportionate impact that Brexit has had on the Irish fishing industry, including the imbalances in the quota transfers under the trade and cooperation agreement, right? I mean, people might be sure there's no more than 50% of the gross tonnage of kilowatt power of the total boats fishing between Ireland's 12-mile limit and 200-mile limit should come from outside of Ireland. But unfortunately, that's not the way things are. And there's huge change required from the European Commission this year when this common fishery policy is being reviewed in order to save the lives of fishermen and fishing communities all around the island of Ireland.
Isn't it a really good or a bad example of the servile nature of the Irish establishment who, in their efforts to be good Europeans, don't speak out against this theft of our natural resources and are happy to sacrifice our fishing communities to the gods of the European altar, which we are net contributors to. It's not as if we're getting out more than we're putting in. We're being bled on this, and the Irish are doing nothing. Leaders are doing nothing to defend it.
The Irish public at home should be asking, how come the Irish media are not interested in fighting the corner of fishermen who have been treated so badly for 40 years, so badly. Yeah. They just haven't had a voice, and it's a huge failing on the part of Irish mainstream media.
Yeah, not a criticism now, of the EU there.
I also got speaking time on, there was a China-EU summit last week, and Borrell obviously went there and, oh, he really kicked ass, and everyone's very impressed that he didn't, there was no smiles and handshakes. Oh, we were going to show the Chinese. I mean, mother of God, what planet do these people live on? And I just pointed out to them, because they were mixing it with the Ukraine war the whole time, obviously, right? And the Chinese president actually made four proposals on the Ukrainian crisis during the summit. He's been accused of being pro-Russian because he didn't condemn them, right? Now, what he said was, he says we should insist on promoting peace talks. Yeah. He says we should insist on measures to prevent a wider humanitarian crisis. He says that we must build lasting peace in Europe and Eurasia, and we must prevent regional conflicts from spreading. And the day before, right, just before the meeting, The Chinese foreign minister spokesperson insisted, and this is a quote from him, he says, China disapproves of solving problems through sanctions, and we're even more opposed to unilateral sanctions and long-arm jurisdiction that have no basis in international law. And he says, and he went on to say that Beijing would not be forced to choose a side or adopt a simplistic friend or foe approach. We should in particular resist the Cold War thinking and block confrontation, because listen, the way that the EU are behaving at the behest of the US and NATO at the moment, we are heading back to crazy Cold War bloc confrontation. And one last item that I'm going to mention, right, because I know we have to run out of here. But I got an email off a guy, a fellow called Sean, right? And he was talking about the sanctions. And I mean, you know, I mean, we've had MEPs standing up in the Parliament today saying, oh, stop all oil to Germany. Stop all gas to Germany from Russia. Yeah, well, okay. But who's going to pay the 400,000 or 500,000 are going to be laid off? I'd like to know the answer to that, because you know what, the populist Fianna Fáil are not given that answer, because like they were going on with today. But this man, right, just on the issue of sanctions and about Russian gas, he pointed out that a lot of the Russian gas that goes to Europe, right, is on a take or pay contract basis, which means even if Europe cuts its demand for gas from Russia, we'll have to pay Russia anyway until these contracts have run their course, right? Now, I suspect, he says, that a contract will only be a contract if it suits Europe-US. Otherwise, contract law will be quietly disposed of, as it was when the US started stealing the central bank reserves of foreign countries. And he says, under the take or pay contracts, European buyers would be in breach of contract if they refuse to take or pay for the gas they have contractually signed up to. Gazprom would win any court case. Oh my God, he says. I mean, but isn't it interesting though? And I find the media bubble, the mainstream media bubble and the Twitter bubble is so out of sync with the general public in Ireland. Mm. The amount of contact we've got from ordinary people who just don't see it their way. It was interesting that the opinion polls, given all the nonsense that mainstream media and the pro-US imperialism, pro-NATO think line that the Irish media have been thrown at the people of Ireland, almost two-thirds of them still oppose joining NATO after all that nonsense been thrown at them. It really speaks volumes.
It does, and it's our past as a country which was colonised and was at the receiving end of militarism before, I think, has to be feeding into that. So look at, I mean, another week here. I'm off with one of our Greek colleagues, Stelios Kalouglou, back to Lesvos this afternoon for the trial of Amir and Rasouli, the two Afghan refugees who are being, well, they've already served 2 years of a 50-year sentence for people smuggling. We hope that reason will be heard tomorrow. We're allowed to give testimony, which is great. One of the reasons and one of the problems is the transposition of EU anti-smuggling legislation into Greek law allows a situation where humanitarian aid workers such as Sean Binder, the Irish guy, and others and asylum seekers themselves have been at the receiving end of being criminalised for this. It's unbelievable. I don't think you'll be reading about it in the Irish media. But this is the other side of how other refugees are treated in Europe. So we'll be there tomorrow and we hope we'll have good news for you after their court case.
All the best. Good luck.
Au revoir.